Harv brings Nell a present. She experiments with the Primer. When Harv came back home, he was walking with all of his weight on one foot. When the light struck the smudges on his face in the right way, Nell could see streaks of red mixed in with the dirt and the toner. He was breathing fast, and he swallowed heavily and often, as though throwing up were much on his mind. But he was not empty-handed. His arms were crossed tightly across his belly. He was carrying things in his jacket.
"I made out, Nell," he said, seeing his sister's face and knowing that she was too scared to talk first. "Didn't get much, but got some. Got some stuff for the flea circus."
Nell wasn't sure what the flea circus was, but she had learned that it was good to have stuff to take there, that Harv usually came back from the flea circus with an access code for a new reactive. Harv shouldered the light switch on and kneeled in the middle of the room before relaxing his arms, lest some small thing fall out and be lost in a corner. Nell sat in front of him and watched. He took out a piece of jewelry, swinging ponderously at the end of a gold chain. It was circular, smooth gold on one side and white on the other. The white side was protected under a flattened glass dome. It had numbers written around the edge, and a couple of slender metal things like daggers, one longer than the other, joined at their hilts in the center. It made a noise like mice trying to eat their way through a wall in the middle of the night. Before she could ask about it, Harv had taken out other things. He had a few cartridges from his mite trap. Tomorrow Harv would take the cartridge down to the flea circus and find out if he'd caught anything, and whether it was worth money. There were other things like buttons, but Harv saved the biggest thing for last, and he withdrew it with ceremony.
"I had to fight for this, Nell," he said. "I fought hard because I was afraid the others would break it up for parts. I'm giving it to you."
It appeared to be a flat, decorated box. Nell could tell immediately that it was fine. She had not seen many fine things in her life, but they had a look of their own, dark and rich like chocolate with glints of gold.
"Both hands," Harv admonished her. "It's heavy."
Nell reached out with both hands and took it. Harv was right. It was heavier than it looked. She had to lay it down in her lap or she'd drop it. It was not a box at all. It was a solid thing. The top was printed with golden letters. The left edge was rounded and smooth, made of something that felt warm and soft but strong. The other edges were indented slightly, and they were cream-colored. Harv could not put up with the weight.
"Open it," he said. "How?"
Harv leaned toward her, caught the upper right corner under his finger, and flipped it. The whole lid of the thing bent upward around a hinge on the left side, pulling a flutter of cream-colored leaves after it. Underneath the cover was a piece of paper with a picture on it and some more letters. On the first page of the book was a picture of a little girl sitting on a bench. Above the bench was a thing like a ladder, except it was horizontal, supported at each end by posts. Thick vines twisted up the posts and gripped the ladder, where they burst into huge flowers. The girl had her back to Nell. She was looking down a grassy slope sprinkled with little flowers toward a blue pond. On the other side of the pond rose mountains, like the ones they supposedly had in the middle of New Chuzan, where the fanciest Vickies of all had their estival houses. The girl had a book open on her lap. The facing page had a little picture in the upper left, consisting of more vines and flowers wrapped around a giant egg-shaped letter. But the rest of that page was nothing but tiny black letters without decoration. Nell turned it and found two more pages of letters, though a couple of them were big ones with pictures drawn around them. She turned another page and found another picture. In this one, the little girl had set aside her book and was talking to a big black bird that had apparently gotten its foot tangled up in the vines overhead. She flipped another page. The pages she'd already turned were under her left thumb. They were trying to work their way loose, as if they were alive. She had to press down harder and harder to keep them there. Finally, they bulged up in the middle and slid out from underneath her thumb and flop, 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 returned to the beginning of the story.
"Once upon a time," said a woman's voice, "there was a little girl named Elizabeth who liked to sit in the bower in her grandfather's garden and read storybooks." The voice was soft, meant just for her, with an expensive Victorian accent. Nell slammed the book shut and pushed it away. It slid across the floor and came to rest by the sofa. The next day, Mom's boyfriend, Tad, came home in a bad mood. He slammed his six-pack down on the kitchen table, pulled out a beer, and headed for the living room. Nell was trying to get out of the way. She picked up Dinosaur, Duck, Peter Rabbit, and Purple, her magic wand, a paper bag that was actually a car her kids could drive around in, and a piece of cardboard that was a sword for killing pirates. Then she ran for the room where she and Harve slept, but Tad had already come in with his beer and begun rooting through the stuff on the sofa with his other hand, trying to find the control pad for the Mediatron. He threw a lot of Harve's and Nell's toys on the floor and then stepped on the book with his bare foot.
"Ouch! God damn it!"
Tad shouted. He looked down at the book in disbelief.
"What the fuck is this?"
He wound up as if to kick it, then thought better of it, remembering he was barefoot. He picked it up and hefted it, looking straight at Nell and getting a fix on her range and azimuth.
"Stupid little cunt! How many times do I have to tell you to keep your fucking shit cleaned up?"
Then he turned away from her slightly, wrapping his arm around his body, and snapped the book straight at her head like a frisbee. She stood watching it come toward her because it did not occur to her to get out of the way, but at the last moment the covers flew open. The pages spread apart. They all bent like feathers as they hit her in the face, and it didn't hurt at all. The book fell to the floor at her feet, open to an illustrated page. The picture was of a big dark man and a little girl in a cluttered room, and the man angrily flinging a book at the little girl's head. "Once upon a time, there was a little girl named Cunt," the book said.
"My name is Nell," Nell said.
A tiny disturbance propagated through the grid of letters on the facing page.
"Your name is Mud if you don't fucking clean this shit up," Tad said. "But do it later. I want some fucking privacy for once."
Nell's hands were full, and so she shoved the book down the hallway into the kids' room with her foot. She dumped all her stuff on her mattress and then ran back and shut the door. She left her magic wand and sword nearby in case she should need them, then set Dinosaur, Duck, Peter, and Purple into bed, all in a neat line, and pulled the blanket up under their chins.
"Now you go to bed, and you go to bed, and you go to bed, and you go to bed. And be quiet, because you are all being naughty and bothering Tad, and I'll see you in the morning."
Nell was putting her children to bed and decided to read them some stories, said the book's voice. Nell looked at the book, which had flopped itself open again, this time to an illustration showing a girl who looked much like Nell, except that she was wearing a beautiful flowing dress and had ribbons in her hair. She was sitting next to a miniature bed with four children tucked beneath its flowered coverlet. A dinosaur, a duck, a bunny, and a baby with purple hair. The girl who looked like Nell had a book on her lap. For some time, Nell had been putting them to bed without reading to them, the book continued. But now the children were not so tiny anymore, and Nell decided that in order to bring them up properly, they must have bedtime stories. Nell picked up the book and set it on her lap. Nell's first experiences with the primer. The book spoke in a lovely contralto, with an accent like the very finest Vicky's. The voice was like a real person's, though not like anyone Nell had ever met. It rose and fell like slow surf on a warm beach, and when Nell closed her eyes, it swept her out into an ocean of feelings. Once upon a time, there was a little princess named Nell who was imprisoned in a tall, dark castle on an island in the middle of a great sea with a little boy named Harve, who was her friend and protector. She also had four special friends named Dinosaur, Duck, Peter Rabbit, and Purple. Princess Nell and Harve could not leave the dark castle, but from time to time a raven would come to visit them.
"What's a raven?"
Nell said. The illustration was a colorful painting of the island seen from up in the sky. The island rotated downward and out of the picture, becoming a view toward the ocean horizon. In the middle was a black dot. The picture zoomed in on the black dot, and it turned out to be a bird. Big letters appeared beneath. R-A-V-E-N, the book said. Raven. Now say it with me.
Raven.
Very good. Nell, you are a clever girl, and you have much talent with words. Can you spell, Raven? Nell hesitated. She was still blushing from the praise. After a few seconds, the first of the letters began to blink. Nell prodded it. The letter grew until it had pushed all the other letters and pictures off the edges of the page. The loop on top shrank and became a head, while the line sticking out the bottom developed into legs and began to scissor. "A is for run," the book said. The picture kept on changing until it was a picture of Nell. Then something fuzzy and red appeared beneath her feet. "Nell runs on the red rug," the book said, and as it spoke, new words appeared.
"Why is she running?"
"Because an angry alligator appeared," the book said, and panned back quite some distance to show an alligator, waddling along ridiculously, no threat to the fleet Nell. The alligator became frustrated and curled itself into a circle, which became a small letter. "A is for alligator." The very vast alligator vainly viewed Nell's valiant velocity. The little story went on to include an excited elf who was nibbling noisily on some nuts. Then the picture of the raven came back with the letters beneath. "Raven. Can you spell raven, Nell?" A hand materialized on the page and pointed to the first letter.
"R," Nell said. "Very good. You are a clever girl, Nell, and good with letters," the book said. "What is this letter?"
And it pointed to the second one. This one Nell had forgotten, but the book told her a story about an ape named Albert.
A young hooligan before the court of Judge Fang. The magistrate confers with his advisors. Justice is served.
The revolving chain of a nunchuck has a unique radar signature, reminiscent of that of a helicopter blade, but noisier, Miss Powell said, gazing up at Judge Fang over the half-lenses of her phenomenoscopic spectacles. Her eyes went out of focus, and she winced. She had been lost in some enhanced three-dimensional image, and the adjustment to dull reality was disorienting.
"A cluster of such patterns was recognized by one of Shanghai PD's sky eyes at 10 seconds after 2351 hours.
As Miss Powell worked her way through this summary, images appeared on the big sheet of mediatronic paper that Judge Fang had unrolled across his brocade tablecloth and held down with carved jade paperweights. At the moment, the image was a map of a leased territory called Enchantment, with one location, near the causeway, highlighted. In the corner was another pane containing a standard picture of an anti-crime sky eye, which always looked to Judge Fang like an American football as redesigned by fetishists, glossy and black and studded. Miss Powell continued.
"The sky eye dispatched a flight of 8 smaller aerostats equipped with cine cameras."
The kinky football was replaced by a picture of a teardrop-shaped craft, about the size of an almond, trailing a whip antenna, with an orifice at its nose protected by an incongruously beautiful iris. Judge Fang was not really looking. At least 3/4 of the cases that came before him commenced with a summary almost exactly like this one. It was a credit to Miss Powell's seriousness and diligence that she was able to tell each story afresh. It was a challenge to Judge Fang's professionalism for him to listen to each one in the same spirit. "Converging on the scene," Miss Powell said, "they recorded activities." The large map image on Judge Fang's scroll was replaced by a cine feed. The figures were far away, flocks of relatively dark pixels nudging their way across a rough gray background like starlings massing before a winter gale. They got bigger and more clearly defined as the aerostat flew closer to the action. A man was curled on the street with his arms wrapped around his head. The nunchucks had been put away by this point, and hands were busy going through the innumerable pockets that were to be found in a gentleman's suit. At this point, the cine went into slow-mo. A watch flashed and oscillated hypnotically at the end of its gold chain. A silver fountain pen glowed like an ascending rocket and vanished into the folds of someone's mite-proof raiment. And then out came something else, harder to resolve, larger, mostly dark, white around the edge. A book, perhaps.
"Heuristic analysis of the cine feed suggested a probable violent crime in progress," Miss Powell said.
Judge Fang valued Miss Powell's services for many reasons, but her deadpan delivery was especially precious to him.
so the Sky Eye dispatched another flight of aerostats specialized for tagging.
An image of a taggerstat appeared, smaller and narrower than the cinestats, reminiscent of a hornet with the wings stripped off. The nacelles containing the tiny air turbines, which gave such devices the power to propel themselves through air, were prominent. It was built for speed.
"The suspected assailants adopted countermeasures," Miss Powell said, again using that deadpan tone.
On the cine feed, the criminals were retreating. The cinestat followed them with a nice tracking shot. Judge Fang, who had watched thousands of hours of film of thugs departing from the scenes of their crimes, watched with a discriminating eye. Less sophisticated hoodlums would simply have run away in a panic, but this group was proceeding methodically, two to a bicycle, one person pedaling and steering while the other handled the countermeasures. Two of them were discharging fountains of material into the air from canisters on their bicycles' equipment racks, like fire extinguishers, waving the nozzles in all directions.
"Following a pattern that has become familiar to law enforcement," Miss Powell said, "they dispersed adhesive foam that clogged the intakes of the stats' air turbines, rendering them inoperative."
The big mediatron had also taken to emitting tremendous flashes of light that caused Judge Fang to close his eyes and pinch the bridge of his nose. After a few of these, the cinefeed went dead.
"Another suspect used strobe illumination to pick out the locations of the cinestats, then disabled them with pulses of laser light, evidently using a device designed for this purpose that has recently become widespread among the criminal element in the LT.
The big mediatron cut back to a new camera angle on the original scene of the crime. Across the bottom of the scroll was a bar graph depicting the elapsed time since the start of the incident, and the practiced Judge Fang noted that it had jumped backward by a quarter of a minute or so. The narrative had split, and we were now seeing the other fork of the plot. This feed depicted a solitary gang member who was trying to climb aboard his bicycle even as his comrades were riding away on contrails of sticky foam. But the bike had been mangled somehow and would not function. The youth abandoned it and fled on foot. Up in the corner, the small diagram of the tagging aerostat zoomed in to a high magnification, revealing some of the device's internal complications so that it began to look less like a hornet and more like a cutaway view of a starship. Mounted in the nose was a device that spat out tiny darts drawn from an interior magazine. At first, these were almost invisibly tiny, but as the view continued to zoom, the hull of the tagging aerostat grew until it resembled the gentle curve of a planet's horizon, and the darts became more clearly visible. They were hexagonal in cross-section, like pencil stubs. When they were shot out of the tag's stat nose, they sprouted cruel barbs at the nose and a simple empennage at the tail.
"The suspect had experienced a ballistic interlude earlier in the evening," Miss Powell said, "regrettably not filmed, and relieved himself of excess velocity by means of an ablative technique."
Miss Powell was outdoing herself. Judge Fang raised an eyebrow at her, briefly hitting the pause button. Chang, Judge Fang's other assistant, rotated his enormous, nearly spherical head in the direction of the defendant, who was looking very small as he stood before the court. Chang, in a characteristic gesture, reached up and rubbed the palm of his hand back over the short stubble that covered his head, as if he could not believe he had such a bad haircut. He opened his sleepy, slit-like eyes just a notch and said to the defendant,
"She say you have road rash."
The defendant, a pale, asthmatic boy, had seemed too awed to be scared through most of this. Now the corners of his mouth twitched. Judge Fang noticed with approval that he controlled the impulse to smile.
"Consequently," Miss Powell said, "there were lapses in his nanobar integument. An unknown number of tag mites passed through these openings and embedded themselves in his clothing and flesh. He discarded all of his clothing and scrubbed himself vigorously at a public shower before returning to his domicile, but 350 tag mites remained in his flesh and were later extracted during the course of our examination. As usual, the tag mites were equipped with inertial navigation systems that recorded all of the suspect's subsequent movements."
The big cinefeed was replaced by a map of the leased territories, with the suspect's movements traced out with a red line. This boy did a lot of wandering about, even going into Shanghai on occasion, but he always came back to the same apartment.
"After a pattern was established, the tag mites automatically spored," Miss Powell said.
The image of the barbed dart altered itself, the midsection, which contained a taped record of the dart's movements, breaking free and accelerating into the void. Several of the spores found their way to a sky eye, where their contents were downloaded and their serial numbers checked against police records. It was determined that the suspect spent much of his time in a particular apartment. Surveillance was placed on that apartment. One of the residents clearly matched the suspect seen on the cine feed. The suspect was placed under arrest and additional tag mites found in his body, tending to support our suspicions.
Ooh, Chang blurted absently, as if he just remembered something important.
What do we know about the victim? Judge Fang said.
The cine stack could track him only as far as the gates of New Atlantis, Miss Pao said. His face was bloody and swollen, complicating identification.
He had also been tagged, naturally. The tagger aerostat cannot make any distinction between victim and perpetrator, but no spores were received. We can assume that all of his tag mites were detected and destroyed by Atlantis Shanghai's immune system.
At this point, Miss Pao stopped talking and swiveled her eyes in the direction of Chang, who was standing quiescently with his hands clasped behind his back, staring down at the floor as if his thick neck had finally given way under the weight of his head. Miss Pao cleared her throat once, twice, three times, and suddenly Chang came awake.
"Excuse me, Your Honor," he said, bowing to Judge Fang.
He rummaged in a large plastic bag and withdrew a gentleman's top hat in poor condition.
"This was found at the scene," he said, finally reverting to his native Shanghainese.
Judge Fang dropped his eyes to the tabletop and then looked up at Chang. Chang stepped forward and placed the hat carefully on the table, giving it a little nudge as if its position were not quite perfect. Judge Fang regarded it for a few moments, then withdrew his hands from the voluminous sleeves of his robe, picked it up, and flipped it over. The words, John Percival Hackworth, were written in gold script on the hatband. Judge Fang cast a significant look at Miss Pao, who shook her head. They had not yet contacted the victim. Neither had the victim contacted them, which was interesting. John Percival Hackworth must have something to hide. The Neo-Victorians were smart. Why did so many of them get mugged in the leased territories after an evening of brothel crawling?
"You have recovered the stolen items?" Judge Fang said.
Chang stepped to the table again and laid out a man's pocket watch. Then he stepped back, hands clasped behind him, bent his neck again, and watched his feet, which could not contain themselves from shuffling back and forth in tiny increments. Miss Pao was glaring at him.
"There was another item? A book, perhaps?" Judge Fang said.
Chang cleared his throat nervously, suppressing the urge to hawk and spit, an activity Judge Fang had barred in his courtroom. He turned sideways and backed up one step, allowing Judge Fang to view one of the spectators. A young girl, perhaps 4 years old, sitting with her feet up on the chair so that her face was blocked by her knees. Judge Fang heard the sound of a page turning and realized that the girl was reading a book propped up on her thighs. She cocked her head this way and that, talking to the book in a tiny voice.
"I must humbly apologize to the judge," Chang said in Shanghainese. "My resignation is hereby proffered."
Judge Fang took this with due gravity.
"Why?"
"I was unable to wrest the evidence from the young one's grasp," Chang said.
"I have seen you kill adult men with your hands," Judge Fang reminded him.
He had been raised speaking Cantonese, but could make himself understood to Chang by speaking a kind of butchered Mandarin.
"Age has not been kind," Chang said.
He was 36.
"The hour of noon has passed," said Judge Fang. "Let us go and get some Kentucky Fried Chicken."
"As you wish, Judge Fang," said Chang.
"As you wish, Judge Fang," said Miss Pao.
Judge Fang switched back to English.
"Your case is very serious," he said to the boy. "We will go and consult the ancient authorities. You will remain here until we return."
"Yes, sir,"
said the defendant, abjectly terrified. This was not the abstract fear of a first-time delinquent. He was sweating and shaking. He had been caned before. The house of the venerable and inscrutable colonel was what they called it when they were speaking Chinese. Venerable because of his goatee, white as the dogwood blossom, a badge of unimpeachable credibility in Confucian eyes. Inscrutable because he had gone to his grave without divulging the secret of the 11 herbs and spices.
It had been the first fast food franchise established on the Bund many decades earlier. Judge Fang had what amounted to a private table in the corner. He had once reduced Chang to a state of catalepsis by describing an avenue in Brooklyn that was lined with fried chicken establishments for miles, all of them rip-offs of Kentucky Fried Chicken. Miss Pau, who had grown up in Austin, Texas, was less easily impressed by these legends. Word of their arrival preceded them. Their bucket already rested upon the table. The small plastic cups of gravy, coleslaw, potatoes, and so on had been carefully arranged. As usual, the bucket was placed squarely in front of Chang's seat, for he would be responsible for consumption of most of it. They ate in silence for a few minutes, communicating through eye contact and other subtleties, then spent several minutes exchanging polite, formal chatter. "Something struck a chord in my memory," Judge Fang said, when the time was right to discuss business. "The name Tequila. The mother of the suspect and of the little girl. The name has come up before our court twice before," Miss Pau said, and refreshed his memory of two previous cases, one almost 5 years ago in which this woman's lover had been executed, and the second only a few months ago, a case quite similar to this one.
"Ah, yes," Judge Fang said. "I recall the second case. This boy and his friends beat a man severely, but nothing was stolen. He would not give a justification for his actions. I sentenced him to 3 strokes of the cane and released him."
"There is reason to suspect that the victim in that case had molested the boy's sister," Chang put in, "as he has a previous record of such accomplishments."
Judge Fang fished a drumstick out of the bucket, arranged it on his napkin, folded his hands, and sighed.
"Does the boy have any filial relationships whatsoever?"
"None," said Miss Pau.
"Would anyone care to advise me?"
Judge Fang frequently asked this question. He considered it his duty to teach his subordinates. Miss Pau spoke, using just the right degree of cautiousness.
"The master says the superior man bends his attention to what is radical. That being established, all practical courses naturally grow up. Filial piety and fraternal submission. Are they not the root of all benevolent actions?
How do you apply the master's wisdom in this instance?
The boy has no father. His only possible filial relationship is with the state. You, Judge Fang, are the only representative of the state he is likely to encounter. It is your duty to punish the boy firmly, say with 6 strokes of the cane. This will help to establish his filial piety. But the master also said, if the people be led by laws and uniformity sought to be given them by punishments, they will try to avoid the punishments, but have no sense of shame. Whereas if they be led by virtue and uniformity sought to be given them by the rules of propriety, they will have the sense of shame and, moreover, will become good.
So you are advocating leniency in this case? Miss Pau said somewhat skeptically. Chang chimed in.
Mang Wu asked what filial piety was. The master said, parents are anxious lest their children should be sick. But the master said nothing about caning.
Miss Pau said, the master also said, rotten wood cannot be carved, and there are only the wise of the highest class and the stupid of the lowest class who cannot be changed.
So the question before us is the boy rotten wood?
His father certainly was.
I am not certain about the boy yet.
With utmost respect, I would direct your attention to the girl, said Chang, who should be the true subject of our discussions. The boy may be lost. The girl can be saved.
Who will save her? Miss Pau said. We have the power to punish. We are not given the power to raise children.
This is the essential dilemma of my position, Judge Fang said. The Mao dynasty lacked a real judicial system. When the Coastal Republic arose, a judicial system was built upon the only model the Middle Kingdom had ever known, that being the Confucian. But such a system cannot truly function in a larger society that does not adhere to Confucian precepts. From the Son of Heaven down to the mass of the people, all must consider the cultivation of the person the root of everything besides.
Yet how am I to cultivate the persons of the barbarians for whom I have perversely been given responsibility?
Chang was ready for this opening and exploited it quickly.
The master stated in his great learning that the extension of knowledge was the root of all other virtues.
I cannot send the boy to school, Chang.
Think instead of the girl, Chang said. The girl and her book.
Judge Fang contemplated this for a few moments, though he could see that Miss Pao badly wanted to say something. The superior man is correctly firm, and not firm merely, Judge Fang said. Since the victim has not contacted the police seeking return of his property, I will allow the girl to keep the book for her own edification. As the master said, in teaching there should be no distinction of classes. I will sentence the boy to 6 strokes of the cane, but I will suspend all but one of those strokes since he has displayed the beginnings of fraternal responsibility by giving the book to his sister. This is correctly firm. I have completed a phenomenoscopic survey of the book, Miss Pao said. It is not an ordinary book. I had already surmised that it was a reactive of some sort, Judge Fang said. It is considerably more sophisticated than that description implies. I believe that it may embody hot IP, Miss Pao said. You think that this book incorporates stolen technology? The victim works in the bespoke division of machine phase systems. He is an artifex.
Interesting, Judge Fang said.
Is it worthy of further investigation? Judge Fang thought about it for a moment, carefully wiping his fingertips on a fresh napkin.
It is, he said.
Hackworth presents the primer to Lord Finkel McGraw.
Is the binding and so on what you had in mind? Hackworth said.
Oh, yes, said Lord Finkel McGraw. If I found it in an antiquarian bookshop covered with dust, I shouldn't give it a second glance.
Because if you were not happy with any detail, Hackworth said, I could recompile it. He had come in hoping desperately that Finkel McGraw would object to something. This might give him an opportunity to filch another copy for Fiona. But so far the equity lord had been uncharacteristically complacent. He kept flipping through the book, waiting for something to happen.
It is unlikely to do anything interesting just now, Hackworth said. It won't really activate itself until it bonds.
Bonds?
As we discussed, it sees and hears everything in its vicinity, Hackworth said. At the moment, it's looking for a small female. As soon as a little girl picks it up and opens the front cover for the first time, it will imprint that child's face and voice into its memory.
Bonding with her. Yes, I see.
And thenceforth, it will see all events and persons in relation to that girl, using her as a datum from which to chart a psychological terrain, as it were. Maintenance of that terrain is one of the book's primary processes. Whenever the child uses the book, then, it will perform a sort of dynamic mapping from the database onto her particular terrain.
You mean the database of folklore?
Hackworth hesitated. Pardon me, but not precisely, sir. Folklore consists of certain universal ideas that have been mapped onto local cultures. For example, many cultures have a trickster figure, so the trickster may be deemed a universal. But he appears in different guises, each appropriate to a particular culture's environment. The Indians of the American Southwest called him Coyote. Those of the Pacific Coast called him Raven. Europeans called him Reynard the Fox. African Americans called him Br'er Rabbit. In 20th century literature, he appears first as Bugs Bunny and then as the Hacker. Finkel McGraw chuckled.
When I was a lad, that word had a double meaning. It could mean a trickster who broke into things, but it could also mean an especially skilled coder.
The ambiguity is common in post-Neolithic cultures, Hackworth said. As technology became more important, the trickster underwent a shift in character and became the god of crafts, of technology, if you will, while retaining the underlying roguish qualities. So we have the Sumerian Enki, the Greek Prometheus and Hermes, Norse Loki, and so on. In any case, Hackworth continued, trickster technologist is just one of the universals. The database is full of them. It's a catalogue of the collective unconscious. In the old days, writers of children's books had to map these universals onto concrete symbols familiar to their audience, like Beatrix Potter mapping the trickster onto Peter Rabbit. This is a reasonably effective way to do it, especially if the society is homogeneous and static, so that all children share similar experiences. What my team and I have done here is to abstract that process and develop systems for mapping the universals onto the unique psychological terrain of one child. even as that terrain changes over time. Hence, it is important that you not allow this book to fall into the hands of any other little girl until Elizabeth has the opportunity to open it up.
Understood, said Lord Alexander Chung-Sik Finkel-McGraw. I'll wrap it up myself right now. Compiled some nice wrapping paper this morning.
He opened a desk drawer and took out a roll of thick, glossy mediatronic paper bearing animated Christmas scenes. Santa sliding down the chimney, the ballistic reindeer, the three Zoroastrian sovereigns dismounting from their dromedaries in front of the stable. There was a lull while Hackworth and Finkel-McGraw watched the little scenes. One of the hazards of living in a world filled with mediatrons was that conversations were always being interrupted in this way, and that explained why Atlantans tried to keep mediatronic commodities to a minimum. Go into Athete's house, and every object had moving pictures on it. Everyone sat around slack-jawed, eyes jumping from the body figures cavorting on the mediatronic toilet paper to the big-eyed elves playing tag in the bathroom mirror to,
"Oh, yes," Finkel-McGraw said. "Can it be written on? I should like to inscribe it to Elizabeth."
The paper is a subclass of both input paper and output paper, so it possesses all the underlying functionality of the sort of paper you would write on. For the most part, these functions are not used, beyond, of course, simply making marks where the nib of the pen has moved across it.
You can write on it, Finkel-McGraw translated with some asperity, but it doesn't think about what you're writing.
Well, my answer to that question must be ambiguous, Hackworth said. The illustrated primer is an extremely general and powerful system, capable of more extensive self-reconfiguration than most. Remember that a fundamental part of its job is to respond to its environment. If the owner were to take up a pen and write on a blank page, this input would be thrown into the hopper along with everything else, so to speak.
Can I inscribe it to Elizabeth or not? Finkel-McGraw demanded.
Certainly, sir. Finkel-McGraw extracted a heavy gold fountain pen from a holder on his desk and wrote in the front of the book for a while. That being done, sir, there remains only for you to authorize a standing purchase order for the Ractors.
Ah, yes, thank you for reminding me, said Finkel-McGraw, not very sincerely. I still would have thought that for all the money that went into this project...
That we might have solved the voice generation problem to boot, yes, sir, Hackworth said. As you know, we took some stabs at it, but none of the results were up to the level of quality you demand. After all of our technology, the pseudo-intelligence algorithms, the vast exception matrices, the portent and content monitors, and everything else, we still can't come close to generating a human voice that sounds as good as what a real, live Ractor can give us.
Can't say I'm surprised, really, said Finkel-McGraw. I just wish it were a completely self-contained system.
It might as well be, sir. At any given time, there are tens of millions of professional Ractors in their stages all over the world, in every time zone, ready to take on this kind of work at an instant's notice. We are planning to authorize payment at a relatively high rate, which should bring in only the best talent. You won't be disappointed with the results.
Nell's second experience with the primer. The story of Princess Nell in a nutshell.
Once upon a time, there was a little princess named Nell who was imprisoned in a tall, dark castle on an island in the middle of a great sea, with a little boy named Harve who was her friend and protector. She also had four special friends named Dinosaur, Duck, Peter Rabbit, and Purple. Princess Nell and Harve could not leave the dark castle, but from time to time a raven would come to visit them and tell them of the wonderful things over the sea in the land beyond. One day, the raven helped Princess Nell escape from the castle, but alas, poor Harve was too big and had to stay locked up behind the castle's great iron door with 12 locks. Princess Nell loved Harve like a brother and refused to abandon him, so she and her friends, Dinosaur, Duck, Peter, and Purple, traveled over the sea in a little red boat, having many adventures, until they came to the land beyond. This was divided into 12 countries, each ruled by a fairy king or a fairy queen. Each king or queen had a wonderful castle, and each castle was a treasury containing gold and jewels. And in each treasury was a jeweled key that would open one of the 12 locks on the iron door of the dark castle. Princess Nell and her friends had many adventures as they visited each of the 12 kingdoms and collected the 12 keys. Some they got by persuasion, some by cleverness, and some they took in battle. By the end of the quest, some of Nell's four friends had died, and some had gone their separate ways. But Nell was not alone, for she had become a great heroine during her adventures. In a great ship, accompanied by many soldiers, servants, and elders, Nell traveled back over the sea to the island of the Dark Castle. As she approached the iron door, Harv saw her from the top of a tower and gruffly told her to go away, for Princess Nell had changed so much during her quest that Harv no longer recognized her. "I have come to set you free," Princess Nell said. Harv again told her to go away, saying that he had all the freedom he wanted within the walls of the Dark Castle. Princess Nell put the 12 keys into the 12 locks and began to open them, one by one. When the rusty door of the castle finally creaked open, she saw Harv standing with a bow at the ready and an arrow drawn, pointed straight at her heart. He let fly the arrow, and it struck her in the chest and would have killed her, except that she was wearing a locket Harv had given her many years ago before she left the castle. The arrow struck and shattered the locket. In the same moment, Harv was cut down by an arrow from one of Princess Nell's soldiers. Nell rushed to her fallen brother to comfort him, and wept over his body for 3 days and 3 nights. When finally she dried her eyes, she saw that the Dark Castle had become glorious, for the river of tears that had flowed from her eyes had watered the grounds, and beautiful gardens and forests had sprung up overnight. And the Dark Castle itself was no longer dark, but a shining beacon filled with delightful things. Princess Nell lived in that castle and ruled over that island for the rest of her days, and every morning she would go for a walk in the garden where Harv had fallen. She had many adventures and became a great queen, and in time she met and married a prince, and had many children and lived happily ever after.
"What's an adventure?" Nell said.
The word was written across the page, then both pages filled with moving pictures of glorious things, girls in armor fighting dragons with swords, and girls riding white unicorns through the forest, and girls swinging from vines, swimming in the blue ocean, piloting rocket ships through space. Nell spent a long time looking at all of the pictures, and after a while, all of the girls began to look like older versions of herself.
Judge Fang visits his district. Miss Pao arranges a demonstration. The case of the stolen book takes on unexpected depth.
As Judge Fang proceeded across the causeway on his chevaline, accompanied by his assistants Chang and Miss Pao, he saw the leased territories wreathed in a mephitic fog. The emerald highlands of Atlantis Shanghai floated above the squalor. A host of mirrored aerostats surrounded that lofty territory, protecting it from the larger and more obvious sorts of intruders. From here, miles away, the individual pods were of course not visible, but they could be seen in the aggregate as a subtle gleam in the air, a vast bubble, perfectly transparent, enveloping the sacrosanct territory of the Anglo-Americans, stretching this way and that in the shifting winds, but never tearing. The view was spoiled as they drew closer to the leased territories and entered into their eternal fogs. Several times as they rode through the streets of the LT, Judge Fang made a peculiar gesture. He curled the fingers of his right hand into a cylinder as though grasping an invisible stalk of bamboo. He cupped his other hand beneath, forming a dark enclosed cavity, and then peeked into it with one eye. When he stared into the pocket of air thus formed, he saw the darkness filled with coruscating light, something like staring into a cavern filled with fireflies, except that these lights came in all colors, and all of the colors were as pure and clear as jewels. People who lived in the LT, and who performed this gesture frequently, developed a feel for what was going on in the microscopic world. They could tell when something was up. If the gesture was performed during a toner war, the result was spectacular. Today it was nowhere near toner war levels, but it was fairly intense. Judge Fang suspected that this had something to do with the purpose of this errand, which Miss Pao had declined to explain. They ended up in a restaurant. Miss Pao insisted on a table out on the terrace, even though it looked like rain.
they ended up overlooking the street 3 stories below. Even at that distance, it was difficult to make out faces through the fog. Miss Pau drew a rectangular package from her bag, wrapped up in nanobar. She unwrapped it and drew out 2 objects of roughly the same size and shape, a book and a block of wood. She placed them side by side on the table. Then she ignored them, turning her attention to the menu. She continued to ignore them for several minutes more as she and Chang and Judge Fang sipped tea, exchanged polite chatter, and began to eat their meals. "At Your Honor's convenience," Miss Pau said, "I would invite you to examine the 2 objects I laid on the table." Judge Fang was startled to notice that, while the block's appearance had not changed, the book had become covered in a layer of thick gray dust, as if it had been growing mildew for several decades.
"Ooh,"
Chang blurted, sucking a lengthy skein of noodles into his maw and bulging his eyes in the direction of this peculiar exhibit. Judge Fang rose, walked around the table, and bent down for a closer look. The gray dust was not uniformly distributed. It was much thicker toward the edges of the book cover. He opened the book and was startled to notice that the dust had infiltrated deep between the pages.
"This is dust with a purpose in life," Judge Fang observed.
Miss Pau glanced significantly at the block of wood. Judge Fang picked it up and examined it on all sides. It was clean.
"This stuff is discriminating, too," Judge Fang said. "It is Confucian toner," Chang said, finally choking down his noodles. "It has a passion for books."
The judge smiled tolerantly and looked to Miss Pau for an explanation.
"You have examined this new species of mite, I take it."
"It is more interesting than that," Miss Pau said. "Within the last week, not one but 2 new species of mite have appeared in the leased territories, both programmed to seek out anything that looks like a book."
She reached into her bag again and handed her master a rolled-up piece of mediatronic paper.
A waitress scurried up and helped move the dishes and teacups aside. Judge Fang unrolled the page and anchored it with various small items of faience. The paper was divided into 2 panes, each containing a magnified view of a microscopic device. Judge Fang could see that both were made to navigate through the air, but beyond that they could hardly have been more different. One of them looked like a work of nature. It had several bizarre and elaborate arms and sported 4 enormous, wildly involuted scoop-like devices arranged 90 degrees apart.
"The ears of a bat!" Chang exclaimed,
tracing their impossibly complex whorls with the tip of a chopstick. Judge Fang said nothing, but reminded himself that this sort of quick insight was just the sort of thing Chang excelled at.
"It appears to use echolocation, like a bat," Miss Pau admitted. "The other one, as you can see, is of a radically different design."
The other mite looked like a spacecraft as envisioned by Jules Verne. It had a streamlined teardrop shape. A pair of manipulator arms folded neatly against its fuselage, and a deep cylindrical cavity in the nose that Judge Fang took to be its eye.
"This one sees light in the ultraviolet range," Miss Pau said. "Despite their differences, each does the same thing, searches for books. When it finds a book, it lands on the cover and crawls to the edge. Then it creeps between the pages and examines the internal structure of the paper."
"What is it looking for?"
"There is no way to tell. Short of disassembling its internal computer system and decompiling its program, which is difficult," Miss Pau said with characteristic understatement. "When it finds that it has been investigating a normal book made of old-fashioned paper, it deactivates and becomes dust."
"So there are many dirty books in the leased territories now," Chang said.
"There aren't that many books to begin with," Judge Fang said.
Miss Pau and Chang chuckled, but the judge showed no sign that he'd been making a joke. It was just an observation.